Good morning, everybody. We're back for our last segment. And with me is attorney Ken Levine. I'm Frank Riccio. My practice is in Braintree, Massachusetts. Ken, we were talking about costs, and I'm going to change the topic just a slight bit, and that is, are there special statutes of limitations for birth injury cases?
Yes, there are, and a little different than the regular statute of limitations in Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, the general rule is that you can bring a case within 3 years of when you knew or when you should have known of the malpractice. We call it something the discovery rule, which is also true around the country. In the birth injury cases, though, you have until the child's seventh birthday to bring the case. And if you don't do it by that time, you will lose your right to do that forever.
So this is different than your typical minor statute of limitations where the minor has up until his or her 21st birthday to bring a claim.
It is different. There's something called the statute of limitations, which is a little bit varied by the discovery, but there's something called the statute of repose, which is a hard and fast rule. In Massachusetts, the statute of repose, the absolute end date, is a child's seventh birthday. And again, it's a protection for doctors in the sense that they know at a certain point in time, if a case has not been brought, then it's not going to be.
Now, bringing a brain injury case is similar to the process that we talked about earlier regarding shoulder dystocia. It's the same tribunal, trial, mediation, arbitration type of format. But in November, actually starting November 4th of 2012, there was a new malpractice law that was passed. And could you tell us a little bit about, you know, what changes that has made or done?
Well, okay. I'll tell you the theory and the fact.
Okay, let's hear both.
And I can tell you the fact based upon our work nationally, because the statute we have now is very similar to a statute from the state of Florida. And what we have now in Massachusetts is we have to give notice to the physicians that we're going to bring suit, that we're thinking about filing suit. They get 6 months to respond. The idea behind it is that it will promote settlement of cases. It'll give the insurance companies a time to talk to the plaintiff's lawyers and come to a settlement. I was one of the few people in this state who did not believe this is an effective change in the law, unlike many of my colleagues, because in the state of Florida, where we have a number of cases, I have yet, in all the cases we've had in Florida, I have yet to have an insurance company call me and offer to settle the case in that interim period.
I gotcha.
So I do not believe in Massachusetts it's going to effectively change how things are done. I don't think it's going to help. I think it's just going to delay cases by 6 months. But the theory behind it is that it will promote settlement. I don't think it will, but maybe I'll be wrong. I've been wrong before.
Yeah, I think we're all pretty skeptical about this. I mean, it definitely creates a hurdle that actually plaintiffs have to comport with, because there are certain risks if they don't comport with it that their case might in fact get dismissed. But there also is a provision in the law about the so-called apology part of the bill. What right. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that comes from a back in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a study done by the University of Michigan where they found that when doctors went to people and apologized for the mistake, people didn't sue as often, and that many people were not motivated by money, as they would like you to believe, but motivated by a need to be told the truth. So that's evolved a little bit. It's what we have now, where under statute now, if a doctor comes to a patient and says they're sorry, that they made a medical mistake, that cannot be used against them at a trial. That apology is inadmissible at the trial of a case.
Now, in terms of the practicalities of it, and again, I guess I could speak a little bit from experience, and you've probably had the same experience with a brain injury case and one that I had handled several years ago. Essentially, there was a meeting with the plaintiff. The plaintiff was unrepresented at the time, and essentially the doctors basically said that stuff happens, and we're sorry about the baby being injured, and that was the end of it. And, you know, as it turns out, we took on the case. We had it vetted by our experts, and there was a case, and ultimately we ended up getting the case resolved. Has that been your experience as well in terms of these meetings with hospital providers?
Well, it's interesting, too, and I'll move slightly to the side of that and bring up one more topic. I know we don't have a huge amount of time, but I think people don't understand this as well. There's something called peer review in hospitals, where after a catastrophic event, a bad event, physicians can meet in the hospital, they can discuss what really happened, and they can decide if somebody made a mistake. That happens in hospitals every day in Massachusetts. We, as the public, are not entitled to that information. And what's most frustrating for us of all is, in the hospital somewhere are records of meetings where doctors have discussed mistakes that they made. And yet we, as a general public, are not entitled to know that. Because we are, by law, not allowed to get peer review information. Now, the doctors say, well, if we gave this information out, we would not promote discussion. But the idea that the doctors are aware of mistakes, the insurance companies are aware of mistakes, that the general public can't find out about, does not seem fair to me. And as you mentioned with these meetings, sometimes they're not open. And eventually, even though doctors might explain that they made a mistake, it's not information we can use.
And there's a tendency to divert the real problem to the person who's injured. Without using the word cover up, it's going to be skewed or towards the doctor or the hospital's perspective, so that the plaintiff, although being reassured, may in fact be given misinformation. Now, a lot of times in these cases, not only are they physically catastrophic cases, they're also economically catastrophic cases. And could you explain that in detail in terms of what the economics of these cases are, not from the lawyer's perspective of bringing it, but from the perspective of the person and the family that now has to deal what could have been prevented?
Well, not only the cost, but what you find also is in either the brachial plexus cases or the other cases, parents have difficulty working. They're taking their kids to therapy. They're in the hospital. They're making multiple medical appointments. Sometimes people just can't sustain the same working time. The families have less money. There's out-of-pocket expense. But the other things, too, which, again, I think it's important to note, the divorce rate amongst families who have kids who have brain-damaged infants is extraordinary. And these are parents that love each other and love these kids. But the stress that's caused on the family unit by these terrible injuries is so intense, it's sometimes very difficult to keep families together. And also, if you've got a family with one brain-damaged child and maybe two other siblings, those kids just don't get the attention. There's just only so many hours of the day the parents can work, care for the children. So the collateral damage that comes from a serious brain injury case, a brain damage injury case, or the brachial plexus cases, there are a lot of other people that are hurt just more than that one child.
And even from a practical perspective, simple things like getting around. For example, on these cases that I've handled, when we've had settlements, we've been able to get vans.
Vans, the equipment. The lifts, the beds, the round-the-clock nursing, the medical supplies, it's tremendously expensive.
I mean, the things that we take for granted in terms of our getting about on a daily basis are not only much more physically difficult to do, but also economically just impossible unless you're very, very wealthy.
Well, you'd say take it for granted. I tell you, it's how simple it is. Young family has a two-year-old baby, normal child. Saturday night, they call the babysitter, they call the college kid down the street, they go to the movies. You have a two-year-old child who's permanently brain damaged at birth. You aren't going to the movies on Saturday night. You're not calling just some 18-year-old kid to come watch your brain damaged child. The simple things that you expect out of life change completely when you have a child injured like this.
And that doesn't even take into account the worry that's involved. Now, In cases with brain damaged children, we've also look, and our duty as an attorney is to protect the interests of the child. How do we do that? How do you do that?
Well, usually at the conclusion of a case, we work very hard to create the appropriate trust documents to make sure the money is protected. And we create different types of trusts for the families to make sure the money is invested carefully and protected, so that when the kids need help, they'll have it. In the brain damage, different cases, they need the help right away, so they have the money right away. Sometimes the brachial plexus cases, the kids need some medical attention, some surgeries, and then as they go through life, there's things they'll need help with.
And do you oftentimes set up so-called special needs trusts for these children?
Yeah, special needs trust is a very interesting. It's a trust that allows the child to receive money and use the money for their benefit, and as they go through their lifetime. It's a very important tool to make sure that the kids are protected and the money is protected.
Now, I think we both agree on this. We both agree that filing these lawsuits do benefit patient care, correct?
In the long run, you know, again, I realize sometimes people.
I'm going to have you jump in. Give me a quick answer.
We are the check and balance. We are the check and balance, and we are the ones. Doctors read our cases and say, "I won't make that mistake in my own practice."
Thank you, everybody. Unfortunately, this hour just flew. This is Frank Riccio, and Bob Flynn will be our host next week, talking about accidents. Thank you so much.
Thanks.